Hi, this is Dave Schlicker from nycwinenotes.blogspot.com, and this is a new thing for us. We're trying out podcast here, and with me today I have my friend Larae Cunningham, who is a friend of mine going back years, who is a fan of wine, much like me, in that we both like to drink it. We thought it would just kind of be fun to sit and talk about, just about things that we see in wine, things we find interesting, and really just kind of have an open discussion. Larae, say hello to everyone.
Hello, everyone.
All three people who will listen to this
Each and
podcast.
every one of you three.
So what we did is we kind of went around and or more like it, I went around and tried to come up with a topic to get us all started. One that I think a lot of people new to wine possibly get a little bit intimidated by. I'm not really sure, but it's how to describe wine. And it can, be as simple, in my opinion, I think it could be as simple as you smell a wine and you're like, oh, this smells nice. And it could be as complex as listing off a whole litany of descriptors: berries, fruits, woods, leather, earthiness, whatever. And I actually truly believe that they're all valid. You describe wine how you experience it, and really, as the bottom line is, as long as you know what you like, that's it. You know what you like, you go out and buy it and you enjoy it. But it's still an interesting thing to talk about, and one of the things that we did is we pulled off an article from slate.com by Michael Steinberger. He is their resident wine writer, and this particular article showed up this past June. It's from the June 15th issue, if you will, and it's titled Cherries, Berries, Asphalt, and Jam. And really, that in and of itself should give you a general idea of what the article is about. Larae, you want to kind of start out with your thoughts, just
All
in
right.
general?
Well, I have a few thoughts as we sit and we drink this Zinfandel. One of the things that I was thinking about is, as I commented to you before, it's that when we have some sort of list of terminologies or whatnot that we associate with a particular kind of wine, like a Zinfandel, tasting the wine in any sort of a authentic mode becomes more and more difficult. Because if I know that Zinfandels are associated with flavors X, Y, and Z, when I smell the wine and try to figure out, oh, okay, what do I find there in its aroma, I'm cued already to list off a particular, litany of key flavors that I associate with a Zinfandel. And I think in that regard, one of the things that beginning tasters bring to the table is that sort of totally randomness of not knowing what they're supposed to be tasting or what they're looking for, or even having the terminology or having the right kinds of, quote unquote, right kinds of adjectives to list off. When you taste wines with people who aren't into wine tasting, sometimes they come up with the most off-the-wall random things like, oh, it tastes like something that you've never heard anybody compare a wine to before.
Yeah, it tastes like old rubber tire or something like that.
Yeah,
Or
although,
there's
yeah.
something. I'm trying to think of the most absurd thing I can think of. My point, I think that's a really good point. The way I feel about that is I think it's all valid.
Yeah.
If they if it smells like that to them, then it smells like that to them.
Yeah.
I do think as and here's a question: as you taste more, as you read more, I think is a very key thing, especially if you subscribe to some of the wine magazines. I think you pick up on the lexicon that other wine writers use,
Right.
and so the things that they come up with all the time, the cherry, berry. Boysenberry is one of my
Yeah.
favorite ones because I actually use it in some of my wine notes, and I can't even think of the last time I even had a
Boysenberry taste like again?
boysenberry. Yeah,
Yeah.
that thing that I don't have a memory of. But I use stuff like that because I think, like you said before, I get cued, as to what I'm supposed to be saying.
Yeah.
And so I kind of like I appreciate the off-the-wall stuff that I think some people come up with. The other thing that I think is that stands out to me, and I noticed this too when I taste a wine, that I'm going to write about or blog about, it's a lot of work. I feel like I sit and I concentrate and I try and come up with the stuff and I go back to it and I step away from it and I go back to it and I write down notes and then I go back and I revise mm-hmm. the notes and then I cross-reference, which is probably the worst thing to do with some of the stuff that's out there on the internet. And it's a lot of work. And then you go and you compose it. And I usually, when I write about some of the stuff on my blog, I try and put a little bit of context around right. it, maybe a little bit of a story. I always try and point out where I bought it. So it's a lot of work that goes into it. But the next time I taste it, whether it's the same bottle later on in the evening after I've done all this, or if it's a second bottle that I might have months down the road, if I know I've already gone through all that work, it's so relaxing to sit down and just drink it.
Yeah.
And really just say to myself, oh, this is such a good wine. And enjoy the conversation with whoever else that I'm having dinner with, or the food that I'm eating with it, or the relaxation I just get from it. It is a lot of work, I think, if you go and try and assess that kind of stuff. And I'm always impressed with wine reviewers who say that they go through and they do this with 100 wines a day or however ridiculous.
Yeah. I remember when I was first being taught how to taste wine, and this is from our mutual friend Zach, who was visiting me in Austin back when I was in college. And he said, you know, he was like, okay, first, you know, you look at the wine, and then you look at the legs of the wine, and then you smell the wine, and then you... And he was listing step after step after step after step after step. And I was like, when do we drink the wine? When does the drinking of the wine part come? A lot of work, especially. And that was just trying to get to the point where we were tasting it.
Right.
You know, I can totally relate to what you're talking about of trying to...
You know, and I think some people are suited to that. And I know I'm one of them. Actually, as much as I say it's hard work, I do know that I like the process.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's for the same reason I think that I like sports. I like going to the for example, I like occasionally, maybe once, twice a year, go to the racetrack.
Uh-huh.
You know, and the reason why I like that is that there is a lot of research that goes into it. If you're going to bet on the ponies, if you will, you look at all their, you know, how fast they ran the last
uh-huh.
time, where they placed, are there other horses that are in the race that they've raced against previously. It's all the research that goes into it that I like.
Perhaps, and given your profession, that would make
profession
sense.
My profession, that I'm a researcher, a media researcher, it does fit. So it's something I definitely like. And I think that's one of the big things that attracted me to wine as well. It's the research that goes into it. And a lot of the research is reading wine notes.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Reading wine notes, and I think one of the things that makes it so personal for me is the associations that I make. For example, I love Indian food,
mm-hmm.
and I love Indian spices, and I am a sucker for wines. If you read the wine note, I don't have to have tasted the wine, I don't even have to know its reputation beforehand. If I read a wine note that says exotic Indian spices, I think I'm going to love it, you
uh-huh.
know, and it kind of, you know, and that's actually one of those terms that I think is somewhat absurd, you know, it's like,
yeah, especially because Indian food is supposedly notoriously difficult to pair with wine, and they always recommend that you drink it with beer,
exactly.
or that you eat Indian food with beer,
exactly,
or something like that.
Exactly, exactly. So it's funny, I definitely play that association game with it.
I was thinking about something that you said a little bit earlier, and you were talking about, you know, how when you're starting to read and do research about wine, and you're reading people's descriptions of wines and stuff like that, and you start to learn about the vocabulary. And I know one of the things that people say a lot is that you're supposed, you know, one of the things that you can do is you train your palate by drinking these wines and taking these notes and reading what other people say and things like that. But when I was listening to you talk and thinking about it, I was thinking, well, what is the difference between training your palate and training your, or I don't know, not adjusting your lexicon, you know, to how are those related, and to what degree is it really training your palate as opposed to just adjusting your vocabulary in order to describe these things?
I kind of feel it's all rolled up into experience
okay.
with wine, and the reason why I say that is I remember the first wine experience that I had, the first quote-unquote real wine experience that I had, and that was in France, where the home, as far as I'm concerned, of fine wine. And my wife and I had a 1975 Bordeaux from the Saint-Émilion region, Émilion. Yeah, my French pronunciation is terrible. And I didn't even know enough about wine to write down the château. I, as far as I was concerned, Saint-Émilion was
That
the
was it,
that was it. It was just like, okay, so it's a joke, literally, that I wrote down 1975 Saint-Émilion. It could have been one of literally hundreds of chateaus that I had, and unless I were to call the restaurant and hope
Oh,
that they still had it,
how far you've
that,
come.
yeah, well, the funny thing is that it was the most profound wine experience that I've ever had, and all the only thing we drank it, we took a sip, and we're like, wow, this is the best wine we've ever had. There was not one adjective that we used to describe the wine. We just enjoyed it because we didn't have the vocabulary at the time. We just didn't have the vocabulary. And I think when you start talking about lexicon, I think that's where the research comes in, is that you start reading about wine, you start seeing other people describe wine in these terms, you start learning some of the science that goes behind making the wine, and it all just kind of gets rolled into this umbrella of experience, and I think the lexicon that you use to describe flavors kind of comes along with it. And yeah, so I don't really know if there is a point that you get to where you start using these terms. Now that I think about it, it probably goes a little bit, again, experience when you start talking to these people who come up with these really left field terms that you've never used or never heard before. They're reaching in a way for whatever they can associate. They haven't been exposed to to all the writers that have come before and have written about these things. So they don't overuse cherry or boysenberry or oak or cedar or any of these other things that I tend to overuse, really.
Well, I did think that this part was interesting, where he says that some of the most commonly observed fragrances in wine are there because of volatile organic compounds that were either in the grapes themselves or that seeped into the finished juice. So it's like in my mind, I always thought that these flavors that we were tasting were sort of, I don't know, they were evocative ghost flavors that somehow lingered in the wine for some mystical reason, as opposed to they actually are organic compounds that yield a particular flavor. Like there's a part in this particular article where he's talking about how a buttery note that's in Chardonnay is an aroma compound called diacetyl, which I don't know how to pronounce that. But the fact that these different smells and tastes are actually worked back to a particular chemical compound in the wine, as opposed to just, oh wow, somehow or another the aging process made it taste like tobacco.
Yeah, no, I think it's a lot of things actually. That I the science behind that, and I'm not even going to pretend to try and pronounce it. I went to a talk at the Cornell Club here in New York, where one of the right now Cornell has a wine program. It's the first one on the East Coast, I believe, and one of the professors, I think he's also a biology professor, gave a talk about aromas in wine, and it was actually, they were talking, he gave a presentation, and then it was followed up by a tasting of a long, from a Long Island winery where the marketing director went to Cornell or something like that. And that was his point, is that in the making of wine, there are all these chemical reactions. It's not just a chemical that's released that creates these aromas, but there are a million different reactions. Well, maybe not a million, but there are a lot of reactions that go on in the fermentation, for example, and that when they come together, create these separate aromas. And that is where a lot of it comes from. And then you read about the psychology that goes behind suggestion, and I think a lot of it comes from that too. And I think it all just kind of gets mixed together, And to the third point, if you want to add a third point into it, it is a lot of the manipulation where you're talking about aging in oak barrels, where you will get that. You'll get the vanilla essence that comes across from that. So there's a lot of manipulation that goes into it. The riper the grape is, the more fruit aromas kind of come off of it. I think that's another thing that winemakers can kind of manipulate in a way by letting the grapes hang on the vine and kind of then become a fruit-forward wine, you know, where then you can pick off, you know, just check off the dozen, you know, red fruits that you can remember, whatever, you know. So, yeah, I think there's a lot that goes into it, but I think a lot of it, truthfully though, I think a lot of it is mental. It's just kind of what you make up, you know.
Yeah. I remember reading about or seeing on, I can't remember if it was if I was reading about it or if I saw it on television, maybe on Diary of a Foodie or something like that on PBS. There was something where I believe it was José Andrés or perhaps Ferran Adrià who was doing, I want to say a horizontal tasting, maybe it was a vertical tasting, some sort of strange tasting where it was essentially a deconstructed Chardonnay where they had a long plate and they had done some sort of weird gelatinous thing with a Chardonnay, but then they'd also put all of the different flavors that existed within that Chardonnay, like butter or you know, some sort of weird oak or some sort of apple, in little clusters around the plate so that you could taste this gelatin. And I may be totally misremembering how this went, but I remember that there were isolated flavor elements that you could taste, and then you could taste the wine itself. And I thought that that must be such an interesting way to help people pick out the flavor notes or the aroma notes or the different elements that exist within a wine to go back and forth between having these little bites of the flavors that exist within the wine.
Well, it's funny that you bring that up because one of the other podcast series that we're going to try and do here at nycwinenotes.com, .blogspot.com, I'm sorry,
Say
is
it all again.
nycwinenotes.blogspot.com. One of the things we're trying to do is go through a book by Jancis Robinson. She's a British wine writer, and she wrote this book in the early 90s, I believe. It's called How to Taste. And she gives all these practice lessons. And in the very beginning of the book, where she's trying to teach you the fundamentals, that's exactly what she does. When, yeah, and we just did this a little while ago in another podcast, and it was so disgusting. We took all these different acidic things, you know, balsamic vinegar, cider vinegar, I think was one of them. We took citrus in lemon and orange. We took aromatic bitters, for example, kind of get a little bit of bitter thing, and we took them all separately, and then we tasted wines after that, and we really immediately after we were really able to pick out the separate elements more so than we were before. So to that point, yeah, I mean, I think you can almost train yourself.
Yeah.
And one of the things, and we up here, we actually have it buried, is a kit. I think it's called the. Hold on. Le Nose du Vin is the name of the kit, and it has something like 50 or 60 different aromas and little.
In little
In little
vials or something.
vials, yeah.
Huh.
And so if you smell something, or if you think you smell something, you can actually go cross-reference it.
That's really cool.
Yeah, so it is kind of neat. But to your point, it is breaking down all those elements of wine into their separate compartments and really trying to deconstruct it. You know, and I guess the question is do you really want to deconstruct a wine, or do you want to take it as a whole, you know? And that's where I think the research actually kind of comes in, the research aspect of it, where if you're in the ha if it's your hobby to or your job, if you're a wine writer, to deconstruct a wine, I really think that you've got to be into the research.
I think one of the things that's super interesting is the way that even if you have a very advanced palate and you have the lexicon, you can still really be easily fooled into describing wines in a particular way simply based on something as easy as what they look like. Because I was telling you this a little bit earlier, there's a study that was done or an experiment that was done where they took a whole bunch of really, really, really learned wine tasters and they had them sit down and taste six white wines. And each one of them tasted the wines and came up with a list of all of these adjectives to describe the wines that are typically reserved for whites. For example, give you a few, like you're the wine taster.
Citrus.
Citrus, oak, you know.
Yeah, oak in a Chardonnay,
Yeah, in
like
a
an oaky
Chardonnay,
Chardonnay,
buttery, or
right.
something, you know, typically white wine words.
Honeysuckle.
Yes. Oh, I love honeysuckle. With or without the wine. So the tasters came up with all of that, and then they were asked if they could guess the wine, what the actual wines were, and they not only were able to describe the flavors that they tasted, but they were able to actually make guesses on the grapes and the wines, and most of them were incredibly accurate. Then there was a switcheroo with the people who were doing the experiment. They took the exact same six wines and they put a food dye in them and turned them into red wines, gave them to the exact same tasters, and had them taste. And these tasters who were tasting these wines that appeared to be red but were in fact the same white wine used an entirely different vocabulary to describe the wine, using terms that are used to describe red wines, such as.
Well, tannic,
Yes.
boysenberry,
Boysenberry, our favorite.
trying to think of earthy is
Earthy,
probably another one.
tobacco maybe.
Tobacco, oak,
Yes.
in another sense.
Yes, a different kind of oak.
Cedar is
Cedar,
one,
oh
yeah.
yeah, cedar. So they used all of these red wine terms, and then they ventured guesses as to what kinds of wine they were, and they guessed red, you know, grapes that go into making red wine, and all of the wines that they chose were red wines. So completely misled by the fact that there was red food dye. Then the researchers blindfolded the tasters and gave them the same wine again, and they all got the guesses correct. They went right back to describing it as what it was, which was a white wine. And they guessed the wines correctly. So just by the element of the color, they were completely misled into using different adjectives, making different guesses. And these are people with incredibly educated palates. I mean,
Yeah.
like you'd think that they could guess between a white wine and a red wine, but the fact that a lot of people are considering that this firm division between reds and whites is kind of non-existent anyway, it's kind of interesting.
No, I mean, it opens up a whole, it really opens up a lot of questions, I think. This is one of my favorite stories, actually.
Okay.
About a year ago, I think it was last year, at the California State Fair or something like that, I can't remember exactly where. It was, but it was out in California. There was a wine competition. All these $100, I think it was, I don't know if it was strictly Chardonnay or if it also entailed other white wine varietals. I can't remember. $100 bottles of white wine from all these esteemed, like Northern California, Napa Valley, Sonoma Coast estates, Central Coast of California, all these great wineries, you know, and some not so great wineries as well. One of the wines in the tasting was Trader Joe's Two Buck Chuck. And guess who won the gold medal?
Would that be Trader Joe's Two Buck Chuck?
It was Trader Joe's Two Buck Chuck. And in the wine press, the backpedaling that happened afterwards, I really think it goes a little bit, you take away, you put on the blindfolds, and everybody gets equal play. You take away that veil, and people then believe they have to think in a certain way. Oh, well, the Heinz, you know, the Heinz Vineyard Chardonnay is so much better than the
Right.
Trader Joe's. But, well, if it was so much better, why did Trader Joe's place first? Now, I don't think, I've had the Trader Joe's Chardonnay since. I don't think it's an amazing wine. But what I do like about it, I think it's a decent wine,
For two
and
bucks, or rather $3
well,
in New
three bucks in
York.
New York, you know. But the thing is that I think there are a lot of elements of suggestion that go into tasting notes, into perceptions, into all of that, you
Yeah.
know. And that doesn't, in a way, it doesn't surprise me that that experiment turned out that way. It's kind of interesting.
It's like those experiments when the experts end up being not so expert,
Yeah,
you know.
talk a little bit about the wine that we have in front of us and see if we can actually come up with a way to a way to describe it and maybe even match it with what other people have kind of written about it. So what we have in front of us is a Ridge from Ridge Vineyards in Northern California. It's a Sonoma Coast Three Valleys, which is actually their entry-level wine. It's 2006, and it is a blend of 80% Zinfandel, 10% Petite Sirah, 5% Carignan, and 5% Grenache. So, you know, we I mean, very basically, I think this is a good wine, but let's see what we think of it. What do you think this has?
I am tasting fruit.
Mm-hmm.
I have to admit that though I am a lover of all fruits, I'm not so good at identifying the boysenberry, the raspberry, the, you know, whatnot in wines. I would say, I don't know, I thought I was getting smoke a little bit earlier, but
yeah, I would definitely, I would definitely agree with that. I think the fruit is there. This is a high alcohol wine at over 14%, and so the grapes, I'm assuming, were pretty darn ripe when mm-hmm. they picked them, so I definitely think there's a lot of fruit there. I don't think it's exactly that easy to pick out the fruit, but I do 100% agree with you with the smoke. I think it's a bit earthy as well. Kind of a little bit of scorched earth is a little, I guess it's a weird terminology for, you know, to talk about a wine or to use to describe a wine. But I definitely think there's a little bit of that there. I think it's more earthy than anything else. I think dried cherries is one of the fruits.
That would be, yeah, that would make sense to me. I'm like, I'm not getting full-on cherry, but dried cherry.
Dried cherry. Yeah. I definitely get cedar off of this. Maybe oak, but, you know, I'm really not that good at the fire. I just pretend to be.
I was getting leather for a while.
I can see leather. But see, this is a whole point of suggestion.
It is, and it's especially interesting since I've got the checklist of aromas sitting in front of me, and as my eye is sort of dancing across the page, I'm like, oh, yeah, I can see leather. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, oh, what is that? Oh, yeah, I can see nutmeg.
Yeah.
Well, maybe not nutmeg. Actually, I don't smell nutmeg in here, but I do definitely get a spice. I'm not quite sure which spice I get, which is odd since I'm rather versed in spices. Or perhaps I'm just being biased based on what I know of Zinfandels.
Do you usually pick up spices in Zinfandels?
I usually pick up spices in Zinfandels.
I mean, maybe it's a power of suggestion, but I think I can see your point. A little bit of a side point. One of the things that for me marks a good wine, in my opinion, or in terms of what I like, is the fact that the aroma changes.
Yeah.
Every time you swirl the glass, and maybe it comes with practice too, but every time you swirl the glass, you get a different flavor. And so you said spices, I swirl the glass, and it's like, Oh yeah, spices. But anyways, let's see what...
I want to know how it's actually described. Are there words in the back of this bottle?
Let's see.
I think that might be maybe a place to start. And then we can hear what the experts say and see if the experts are saying the same things as on the back of the bottle.
Okay, I will read this straight up. Three Valleys is a proprietary name for the only ridge wine blended from multiple vineyard sites. We select softer, more accessible lots from our single vineyards and, taking the role of winemaker literally, create a character we find most appealing. Younger vines from Leighton Estate provide most of the fruit. Older vines on five small Alexander Valley vineyards and one Russian River vineyard make up the rest. The grapes are fermented in their own yeast, pressed on average by the seventh day, blah, blah, blah. Racked to American oak barrels.
Okay.
Dried for 24 months. We blind tasted all, blah, blah.
Nothing about flavors?
Nothing about... this is what it does say. Sensuous structure... And we didn't even talk about texture. We should actually talk about that.
Okay.
And rich fruit, but they don't get into which fruits. Give the wine immediate appeal. It'll be most enjoyable over the next 5 years.
I did find it immediately appealing.
I did too. And I think that's why this is their entry-level wine. You don't have to cellar it or anything like that. I think they take a pretty smart approach. They let you make up your own mind as to what you think it tastes like. But they give you just enough clues.
Fruit.
They give you just enough clues to kind of point you in whatever direction you're going to go in. But in turn, you know, that's one of the funny things about wine writing is the personification. We didn't even touch on that. Lush, sensuous, masculine.
Creamy.
You can use that as well. I think it's a little bit of a style that's starting to go out of date or is going out of date, but it's there. You know, people do still use it, and I definitely use the word lush, which doesn't necessarily have to be a persona trait, but sometimes I think of it as one. And I definitely think this has a certain lushness about it.
Hmm. I'm not getting lush.
Maybe
I
it's
feel like it's
more.
light and bright, which is odd, especially for a Zinfandel.
You know what that light and bright? I think the bright comes from the acidity.
Okay.
I think it comes from that. I'm not getting the light so much, but I do see your point. But I think, yeah, maybe it's all part of the acidity as well. It does have a long finish, and I'm definitely getting the cherries on the tongue if you let it sit on your tongue a little bit. Again, this kind of goes
What do the
into
experts say?
again. This goes all everything we're talking about goes into the folder of you can certainly think too much about this stuff. The experts, and what I did is I pulled up a wine review from Wine Spectator, and this is what they say. Exotic aromas of Chinese five spice. That's interesting. They get really, really literal with, or not literal, but very exact with
Chinese five
Chinese.
spice.
I have no idea what that is. Somebody had probably cooked with it the night before, though. Why would you have that association? I don't know. Toasty oak and plum, which can certainly be mixed into the fruit category that they label on the back of the bottle, lead to concentrated blueberry, tobacco,
Tobacco.
and licorice, the one that we didn't come up with, and licorice too, another one that we didn't come up with, that take on a rustic grip. Rustic and earthy to me are in the same family. Take on a rustic grip of tannins, which to me is, you know, to me that's earthy, on the finish. So, yeah, so it's interesting. You and I sat here and we talked. We came up, I would say they're in the same family, but we definitely came up with different descriptors than Wine Spectator did. So to me, that says there's a whole world of experience and perception and suggestion that goes into all of this stuff, which, you know what, makes it fun. All right, thank you for listening.
Thank you for having me.